If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Hello and welcome back to our new monthly series, History Behind the Headlines. In each episode, our expert panel will be exploring the historical news stories that have caught their eye and the history that will help you make sense of what's going on in the world. Each month, I'm joined by our two regular panelists.
Anna Skoda, I'm a tutor in late medieval history at St. John's College in Oxford.
And I'm Rana Mitter. I'm the ST Lee Chair in US-Asia Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School, and I work on modern China.
Hello to you both, and thank you so much, as always, for being here. We're doing something a bit different on today's episode, because I'm really pleased to say we're joined by award-winning journalist, broadcaster and producer Kavita Puri, whose most recent radio series, 3 Million, explores the devastating 1943 famine that claimed the lives of millions of people in the Indian province of Bengal. This series, which launched on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds back in February, has caused quite a stir, so we wanted to talk more to Kavita about making the series and about some of the wider issues of tackling complex subjects such as famine, which, as a look at today's headlines will attest, is still a problem that's very much with us. This is also a subject that's controversial due to Britain's Second World War story and the role of Prime Minister Winston Churchill. And as you'll hear, it's a story with connections to regular panellist Rana Mitter. Kavita, thank you so much for being here today. Before we go any further and get into some of the wider issues relating to your series, could you just briefly talk through, for listeners who haven't yet had the chance to hear it, what it covers?
So 3 Million covers the famine in Bengal that happened in 1943. 3 Million refers to the number, estimated number of people that died in the famine, which is 3 million. And it is a kind of overwhelming number, and it's probably worth saying it's one of the largest losses of civilian life on the Allied side. And I suppose that's what kind of got me started into all of this in the first place, which is, how on earth is it that we don't know about the people who died, who were British subjects? They were Indian, but they were British subjects, because at that time India was part of the British Empire. And so I look into the famine, but I suppose what I've done that's different is I try and piece it together through eyewitness accounts. And that was quite hard, because it's 80 years on now. And so I suppose it's at the last kind of possible time moment to do that, as that war generation is kind of not going to be with us for so much longer. And so it was not only eyewitness accounts and survivor accounts, but also I went into the archives to find audio testimonies of people who lived through that time. And I try and tell this incredibly complicated story through people. I'm shifting the lens because often this story has been told through the decision makers at the time, whether they were in Calcutta or in Delhi or in London.
And this is obviously a hugely fascinating and contentious subject in some quarters. Hannah and Rana, did you have questions to kick us off that you'd like to get into, I suppose?
Kavita, I should say that I have been listening to 3 Million. It's an immensely moving series. It's not an easy listen, but I think it's an essential listen in all sorts of ways. I found myself thinking about the way in which you were thinking about sources, how to put things together. I think I've rarely heard a series which is about a historical subject, but for broadcast, in which the presenter has been so explicit about the methodological difficulties and the ways in which you can actually reconstruct voices and people at a time when you actually say, as you point out, there aren't that many people left who have many memories of that particular period. I suppose the question I would have is, this is true, I think, of everything that historians do. Having made it and reconstructed so much of this tragic story, is there an element that's still a sort of a hole that you feel is sort of missing there? Or did you feel that the key questions that you wanted answered were, in the end, answered through these different methods of patchworking together sources and voices and viewpoints?
I would say that there is no definitive account of the famine. It affected estimated 3 million lives, and every single story is so different, and millions survived, and those stories are different too. No, I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg. And the thing that I couldn't get at, which was so heartbreaking for me, was that I didn't myself get to interview survivors because I wasn't given a visa. I'm trying now to get a visa. We think that that might be possible. I wasn't able to look into the face of people who had to make those really difficult decisions. So there is a distinction in my mind between survivors who could have died and people who were eyewitnesses who themselves didn't suffer. But of course, this had a huge bearing on their lives. Were there questions I wanted to answer? I suppose the questions I wanted to have answered were maybe different questions that people wanted answered. The question that people always ask me is, was Churchill responsible? I wasn't asking that question. I was interested in knowing why 80 years on, we don't know about this, why there isn't any form of memorial or museum or even a plaque, just a little tiny plaque to these people who died. And when I say anywhere in the world, I thought maybe there would be one in India and Bangladesh, and there isn't. And it's complicated there to remember as well. And so what I'm interested in is memory and remembrance. And what is it that is so painful to touch about this moment in history? And I have some answers, but I don't think I have all the answers because, as you know, memory changes, and what we remember and what we forget changes in time. And maybe there'll be a moment in 20 years, 30 years time where this isn't so painful. In Britain, it's extremely painful. And in India and Bangladesh, it's incredibly complex because I think there are questions that are still not answered there because people didn't behave well, people profited. And as we know, we're watching a famine happen in real time. In Gaza, in Sudan, in Ethiopia, there is so much shame attached to famines because people are forced to make horrific decisions. And some people suffer, in the case of the Bengal famine, and some didn't. And so I just think, honestly, Rana, we're at the beginning of understanding what happened and how that played out.
One of the things, if I remember rightly, I think you may have mentioned this actually at the beginning of one of the episodes, is the reflection of the famine in art. I'm thinking in particular of the 1973 film Distant Thunder, directed by the great Bengali director Satyajit Ray, who certainly would have had memories from, you know, his younger days of that particular period. It's based on a novel of the same name by the novelist Bibhudibhushan Bandyopadhyay. It is perhaps somehow in art that these things get reflected in certain ways. I found myself thinking of a comparison. So I'm a historian of China professionally, and well, again, there's another connection with your series here. One of the voices, and I, you know, recommend people to listen to it, is of the great economist Amartya Sen, who, of course, won the Nobel Prize, today teaches at Harvard. But he grew up in Calcutta in the early years, or actually in Shantiniketan, in the early years of the famine. And a lot of his scholarly work essentially ended up asking questions like, why do famines happen? And one thing, which has ended up being, you know, debated in the field, but I think is a respected conclusion, is that governmental systems can make a difference. Democracies don't tend to have famines, not absolute, I think, but it tends to be that way, and dictatorships do. But linking to your question of memory, in thinking about China, there is a comparator, and a very direct one, as I'm sure you know, with the Bengal famine. And that was the famine in Henan province in central China, almost exactly the same time, 1942-43. That one, I mean, God knows it's not a competition, it should never be, but the approximate figures for that are 4 million, as much as we know anything. And there are a lot of photographs actually taken by American news photographers, people like Theodore White of Time magazine, that shows how horrific the devastation was at that time. The reasons, again, were similar too, a combination of political incompetence, bad weather, and the wartime conditions. But that famine disappeared from Chinese public memory for decades and decades. One of the reasons was that, of course, in the dictatorship under Mao, just 15 years later, there was another famine, the Great Leap Forward, which devastated much of China. And the moment at which actually people started talking about the Chinese famine again was triggered in part by a combination of, you know, local people really wanting to rediscover their own history, and actually an action by, again, an artist, a film director, a man called Fan Xiaogang, sometimes nicknamed China's Spielberg, who made a film called Back to 1942, which is a big screen portrayal of the famine itself. And, you know, I found myself thinking, perhaps apart from something perhaps like the Satyajit Ray movie, the inclusion of the famine experience in a sort of big public way through art, through movies and so forth. Perhaps China has almost done more in the last 10 or 12 years around that particular famine than has yet been done in India.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
So I think in terms of remembrance in India, it is remembered through film and through literature, and in those contemporaneous pieces of art that were made at the time, and photography with people like Sunil Jana, the art of Chitra Prasad Bhattacharya, which is so emblematic of that time. And it's something also I found in Partition, another of India, which is a hugely traumatic event, that somehow literature and art came before survivor testimony. And it often that was because I think survivor testimony was too painful to say and too painful to hear. It was too raw. And it's also worth remembering the people who were telling that story in film or in art were middle class. These were people who hadn't suffered. I don't know if that's the same in China or not. So there is a distance there. What I would say is that the survivor testimony, the collection of what happened in the famine in Bengal, is non-existent. It is now too late for it to happen. It is being done now for the partition of India in India and Pakistan and Bangladesh, but it is too late now. And so, yeah, we have to rely on art or fiction from around that time. But I think that something will be hugely missing from the archive, because I think that when you're dealing with things that are so monumental, like famine, the absence of the lived experience from the archive is quite a huge gap to fill, actually. And so that's partly why I did, to go back to your other question, I did talk about my methodology, because I also wanted to answer a question which I don't say explicitly, but it's not just about this famine. It's like the famine you mentioned about. It's how do you uncover voices and experiences that just don't exist in an archive? And you have to look in different places in different ways. And that's kind of what I was trying to do as well.
The other thing that's very striking about archives is that we tend to assume they give us a sort of snapshot in time. And you make the point very beautifully in the series that horrendous events like this don't just happen at a given moment in time and then that's it. Then life moves on in different ways. But there's this sense that trauma continues to kind of echo through. And as you say, obviously there's a crucial distinction between survivor voices and eyewitness voices. But I think you talk about the ways in which those traumas continue to kind of echo through time for eyewitnesses. I wondered how you deal with that in terms of sort of putting together your material and interpreting things, that sense that trauma doesn't just stop at the quote unquote end of the famine.
It doesn't. And it's what I think about all the time when I see famines happening now, when I see wars happening now. All I ever think is, it's not just that generation. How many more generations is it till you stop feeling that pain, that loss? And what's so interesting to me is that when I interview people who are very elderly now, you know, Amartya was nearly 90. The clarity with which he remembers being a 9-year-old boy and feeling helplessness at being able to do nothing. He remembers not being able to sleep at night. He remembers seeing Jogeshwar, his dear friend, who was 14 years old, at the door of his grandmother's house, who was about to die. Nothing goes away. And I also think there's something about people don't realize how memory plays out. So it was really striking to me that when I went to Rana's father's house, Partha, he had these pictures on the wall. And I don't think, until I'd asked him the question about the famine, that maybe it's related or maybe it's not related. I don't think he'd put two and two together. And we've been having a kind of email discussion afterwards, but he had a lot of clarity of that time. But his memories were of other things. It was only when I specifically asked him about the famine he remembered. And I think he was quite surprised and he was putting things together. And I think he's thought about things quite a lot afterwards. And friends have said to him, now I understand things better. I mean, Rana, I'd love to ask you, if I may, what was it like for you to hear your father recount his experience? And had you ever asked him about the famine before?
Absolutely. And actually, previous listeners to this podcast will know, because I've mentioned it, that my father, Partha Mehta, was one of the interviewees, one of the first interviewees, I think, actually, who comes up in the series. He was younger than Amartya Sen. He was about 5 at that time. But he does have some pretty clear memories of starving refugees coming to the front of their house in Calcutta during the famine year. It really triggered a really interesting set of conversations that I had with Partha, with my father. The paintings that you've talked about, which, I mean, he's a very gifted artist, I have known ever since I was a child, which is, you know, a pretty long time ago now. And I will say, I said to him as well, that there was at least one picture that I always found really quite disturbing to walk past. It's of a, you know, a figure, it's probably a man, it's not entirely clear, bent over, somehow it seems sort of prone almost in the face of some darker force. And the background is deeply dark, it could be nighttime. You know, it's a quite abstract painting in certain ways. I asked him, largely prompted actually by your question in the documentary, whether the famine fed into that image at all, which, you know, I still was there, but I'm not as traumatized as I was when, you know, I saw it when I was 6 or something. And he said that it certainly, I think, hadn't been explicitly driven by the famine, but certainly the feeling that these elements of a turbulent world with these very real consequences that were deeply disturbing, and of course, very, very formative for someone who's that young, must have made a difference. He added in something else, and I think he will have said this to you actually, Kavita, maybe your next documentary, who knows, was that it was shaped by what happened the next, about 3 years later, just after World War II, but before independence in 1946, which was the rioting between Muslims and Hindus in central Calcutta, a very violent time. And he was, of course, 3 years older at that time and has very vivid memories of what was one of the most traumatic and violent events during the partition of India. So for someone at that age, there's a sense, I think, also in which he feels perhaps that these events are brought together. Certainly when I brought up the question of the famine and the image, he brought back the riots as something else that had shaped him. And if you think, I mean, you've mentioned, of course, that there is, of course, still so much to say about partition as well, and we shouldn't, you know, distract from one to the other. But from the point of view of someone growing up in the 1940s, Amartya Sen, my father, you know, a whole variety of other people, my mother as well, actually, lived a different part of Bengal, but during that time, as well as, of course, the departure of the British, you know, in and of itself, it's a hugely turbulent set of experiences to try and absorb and understand at a time when, you know, everything is new and everything is very formative. So now I'm very grateful to you for prompting that particular part of the conversation, which we hadn't had in that way before.
And have you ever thought about, has the famine in any way shaped you, do you think? I mean, people say, you know, you've got to eat everything off your plate. I mean, it was interesting when I spoke to your dad and I said, did anything change for you? And he said, no, we never wanted for rice. I'm embarrassed to say that, which I thought was interesting because he was never hungry. I don't, that's a complicated emotion to feel. Has, in any way, was any of that passed on to you?
Not in quite that sense, although I know where that comes from. And of course, what you're talking about, and you talk about it very brilliantly in the first and second episodes of the series, is about the way in which this was a famine of the poor. It was not, for the most part, middle-class people who were suffering. And of course, a great deal of the suffering was in the countryside. And the reason it was seen in Calcutta was that desperate peasants were essentially coming into the city to try and find food. Something very similar actually happened in the Great Leap Forward famine in China in the 1950s, although again, that's still very much, you know, locked up behind closed doors in terms of Chinese openness about it. We do have a sense that the cities in the end in China got through okay and the countryside was devastated. So I think it's a phenomenon that you see elsewhere in that sense. I would say that the consciousness of both my parents, actually, having grown up in the last days of British imperial rule and then the trauma of partition, and then actually, of course, in many ways, an extraordinarily interesting period, which was the arrival of a new republic, the 1940s and 50s, which for them also was a time of student days. So I think what I gathered and what I still, you know, very much gain from talking to my father and, you know, hearing different versions of these stories, which of course we've had over the years, indeed the decades, in the family, is about all of that as a sequence. The famine sits there at the beginning. And, you know, I would say that there's some evidence that my mother, who grew up along with her sisters and one brother in rural, well, semi-rural Bengal, so a different thing from Calcutta, even though they were very much middle class, the sense that actually there wasn't enough food for them, that was stronger. So the oldest sister, who actually was the one who lived longest of all of them into her 90s, I think, actually, may have been the one who was better fed because she got fed first and before the famine kicked in. And then those who were growing up at a very vulnerable age during the famine year, even though they would have been obviously much more prosperous as middle-class people than peasants, there is some effect there as well. So many complexities, so many threads, and it's really hard to know. As you say, it's too late in some ways to get a definitive take, but that's all there in the narrative.
I work on the 14th century when there's a horrific famine from 1315 to 17, and it's estimated that between 10 and 25% of the population of Northern Europe starve to death during that famine. And then, of course, in the second half of the century, we have bubonic plague and 50 to 60% of the population die. And so many histories of this really reduce the stories to numbers. There's very little sense of the suffering of individuals. And that's partly because of our source material, but I think it's also because people just get very tempted to just rely on the numbers. And what I found really striking in this series was the numbers really matter, not least in your title, and they're utterly appalling and shocking. But together with those numbers, you've put the subjective experience of individuals as well. So there's really a sense of that horrific texture of individual suffering as well as those big numbers.
But that's exactly what I was trying to do, because I think when you have this vast statistic like 3 million, what does it mean? I mean, it's just a kind of number that you bandy around. But literally behind every single number is an individual story. And of course, I can't get to 3 million individual stories, but I can tell some of them. And I don't think there is a dignity in a number. And I also think that when you hear eyewitness accounts, whether they're survivor accounts or whether they're eyewitness accounts, you feel something, because you can imagine, what is it like to be that little five-year-old boy standing at the iron gate, seeing a mother who is so thin she can barely clutch her child, and doesn't even ask for rice, but asks for the starch water of rice. What can you do? You can do nothing. But that image stays with you. And I think whether you feel helplessness or whether you feel, you know, what would I do if I couldn't feed my child? Or would I leave my village? Would I go to a city? I think we can all understand that emotion. And I think that once you feel an emotion, because ultimately that's quite universal, it doesn't feel that far away in history, and it doesn't feel that far away geographically, because as we know, it could be now. And I think once you feel that, you can then try and understand what this huge event is, and actually then try and tackle the really difficult kind of bigger questions about causation, but really about culpability. And I think that that's what eyewitness testimony can do. It can allow you to kind of connect. And I hope that that then allows us to answer some really difficult questions that Britain and India and Bangladesh probably haven't really confronted.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about this idea of culpability, because I think one of the interesting things about this subject is it seems to me that it's both somehow overlooked and also contentious. And I wanted to, while we have the opportunity to talk to you, to talk a little bit about your experiences of making this series and your experiences of perhaps the climate in which we're talking about those kinds of historical issues.
So when I told friends of mine who obviously know about the Bengal famine, historians, what I was doing, they all said, "Are you mad?" And then would like take me to sit down and kind of give me a coffee or often a drink and just say, "Do you know what you're letting yourself in for?" And of course I did. And I was trying to shift the lens. I wasn't asking the question, was Churchill responsible? I was actually trying to do something totally different. But of course I have to, you know, that is still the kind of, there is a context, and I do in some way discuss with Max Hastings, you know, what he thinks about the role of Churchill and his attitudes in terms of his decision making. But it, you know, I mean, I say it right at the start of the podcast, it was totally nerve-wracking, because, you know, you put the word Bengal famine into social media, and my goodness, it's not a civil debate. And I think I'm quite a civil person. I want to have a civil discussion about this. And I'm trying to find the language and that we can start to have a discussion about not just this, but just difficult bits of history. And I don't think we have to, you know, attack or feel blame or feel guilt, but I do think we should know, because these things happened. It's a fact. And it didn't happen that long ago. It's 80 years. There are still people in our country who remember it. And so I think that if we're not talking about it, why aren't we talking about it? So all I'm saying is my podcast was just the start. I hope it will give some form of permission that we can begin to find a language to talk about these things, but not in a fractious way, because I don't think it has to be done in a fractious way.
Could I just add a note there? I mean, again, having heard that episode as well, first of all, as far as I can tell, and I'm not an expert on Indian history, Bengali history, I specialise on China, but obviously, as we've discovered, I have a family connection. But in terms of what I do know about the existing scholarship on exactly the question that Kavita's talking about there, it seemed to me an extremely complex, calm, and nuanced explanation of how there are multiple strands of responsibility. It certainly wasn't either an investigation into was Churchill to blame or not. I don't think, you know, even some of the more strident voices actually step away from trying to pin the blame directly in that sense, because that's not really the question that any historian, I think, would ask in the first place. There are all sorts of complexities to do with supply of grain and goods in war, with the nature of devolved government under the imperial system to local actors, merchants, and so forth. It is a very complex story. And that being the case, I think that because we live in an age that is shrill in all sorts of ways, where voices that are loud and lack very little understanding or sophistication about nuance in history tend to dominate, it's harder to have that space. And that's why I think, you know, listening to that episode, I mean, I tell people again, listen to all of them, but you know, that one, I think, is a beautifully judged example of how one can take things that historians actually spend a lot of time thinking about and present them for a general audience, although I'm hoping that listeners to a podcast called History Behind the Headlines are already fairly much in the headspace where that's a useful thing to do.
But what I'd also say is, and we know this, history is really complicated. And even in the characters that I present, who admitted to taking land and registering it in their name, when people die, they profited. So history is complicated. People are complicated. And actually, that's more interesting. And I think that I hope, as you say, Rana, that we can lean into that and we can acknowledge that. But also, I don't have all the answers. All I wanted to do was to kind of put the famine out there as part of British history, but also as part of our war story, because it's totally not part of our war story. I think that's what is the most complicating thing about the Bengal famine is it's a very difficult bit of colonial history. It's a bit of our colonial history that complicates our war story and the heroes of our war story. So it's kind of got everything in it. I mean, if it was a movie, it'd be great because it's got everything in it, right? But it makes it nerve-wracking to kind of enter this fray, because I don't want to enter this fray. I don't want to get angry on social media, but people are angry. And also, I'll present my programs, and it's nice that you think that you like them, but there'll be lots of people who say, but you didn't include this and you didn't include this voice. You can't make programs for everybody. That's the problem. So, you know, it's difficult. And I think there's still a lot of our history that we need to talk about. Like, you know, you talk about China, Rana, but we don't really talk about in our war story that China were our allies much. I don't think people know that bit of our history.
Well, hence the US title of my book about World War II in China is Forgotten Ally, precisely for that reason.
I know. Exactly. And it's totally forgotten. And maybe next year we will remember that. But it's a good job you've got this podcast, because I think there's a lot of things that we still need to learn about our history.
And then, of course, the question of famine doesn't go away either. So as you said earlier, we can think about famines currently in Sudan and in Ethiopia and in Gaza and in other parts of the world where the suffering is just beyond imagination. And thinking about it historically, I think, is such a crucial move in terms of understanding the sheer complexity of what's going on, but also in terms of this point you've made about dignity as well, of those who are suffering and acknowledging their dignity and trying to think in sort of textured terms about that.
I think one of the things when we were talking about this, Kavita, beforehand, is that the criticism has sometimes, if there is criticism about how you might tackle the subject rather than how you actually has come from the left as much as from the right, if you sort of label people in those terms. How hard is it to please everybody and to tell stories that aren't just going to get a knee-jerk political response?
So I don't think of myself as a historian. I'm a journalist. And I think that you have to kind of put all those thoughts to one side, to be completely honest with you. And I kind of approach what I'm trying to do with integrity. And I have a kind of question that I want to ask, which is, why don't we know? And that's my starting point. And I suppose what I do is my due diligence in that I read everything that's ever been written on the famine. I went back to a lot of primary sources. I did my own personal digging in the archive. So I felt, and also I unearthed new things. So, you know, I made new discoveries that will now be part of the historical archive. So I felt like I had quite a strong position if I was attacked from whatever side. I work for the BBC, so I exercise due impartiality. But I was also telling a story, one that I want to engage listeners with. And it wasn't difficult with a famine because, you know, it is an extraordinary story. The people who try and uncover it, it is, you know, I was joking before, but you could make a feature film of it. The way that the story of the famine is brought to the world and then the British government in London, you know, then reacts to it. So I think you have to do as good a job as you can, be as sure of the things that you're saying. And I'm always aware of the complexity. And it goes back to what we were talking about before with Rana. I like complexity and I'm drawn to that. And so I try and include as much of that complexity as I can in my programs. But, you know, not everybody wants to see that. And I can't, and I'm very prepared to acknowledge that I cannot please everyone and I won't please everyone.
Can I ask you about the power of words? So presumably as a journalist, you know, you're working with words all the time. You also have one really fascinating episode in the series specifically about the word famine and the kind of fraught nature of using this and censorship of the word and so on. In the 14th century, people use the word hunger and it gets allegorized. So it becomes a character with a capital H. And it's an incredibly powerful way of thinking about starvation and suffering and indeed accountability. And it gets used repulsively very often to blame those who are actually starving. But I wondered whether you could tell us a bit more now about the importance of words and why a particular word was quite so contested.
So the colonial authorities under the emergency rules that were passed during the Second World War banned the use of the word famine. And the word famine in India had a particular weight because, you know, there'd already been a number of disastrous famines under British rule and when Britain had a presence there. And in the late 19th century, there was a famine code. And what that meant was if the indicators were fulfilled, there was a duty on the authorities to then alleviate famine. So if famine was used, then there would be during the war, then the authorities would have had to actually do something to help the people in the countryside, which would have meant diverting food away from the war effort, which they didn't want. But secondly, they didn't want the Japanese in particular to use famine or know about famine to use to recruit, but also as propaganda to win Indian people onto their side, which, by the way, they did do. They kind of dropped leaflets to say, you know, we will feed you. But also they didn't want the outside world to know what was happening in Calcutta, the second city of empire. I mean, it would be hugely embarrassing for the British. So for all these reasons, the word famine was banned. And there was a very brave editor who defied the censor, put his job on the line and published photographs because that was a loophole that he could get away with. And then the world knew about it. I mean, it was the 1943 equivalent of going viral, and it really did.
I wonder, Kavita, about something in terms of, you know, perhaps in a sense it was a development that had some positivity from a terrible time in terms of Britain's post-war period, which I'm thinking about the fact that one of the things overall that developed strongly and partly from a colonial base in post-war Britain or post-war British government was the idea of Britain having a responsibility in terms of overseas development issues. And one of the things that is very notable even now is that countries that have been, you know, traditionally connected to the experience of empire and they've reinvented as the Commonwealth have this set of links, which of course partly are political, but also are around these ideas of development. It struck me that over the years, and this goes very recently, I think, actually, in terms of the 2020s as well, that there's been a bit of a struggle in some ways within the British establishment, you might say, sort of government and what surrounds that, that it's partly left-right, but not entirely left-right, about the idea of whether or not actually Britain has a particular expertise or responsibility or sense of need to atone in some ways for the past. It depends which angle you're coming from. Clearly, those who argue that there's a sort of, you know, soft power initiative that means that British development techniques have their own standards would say, no, this isn't at all about, you know, the past. It's about the future. I mean, we wouldn't dream of saying that. And others perhaps who sit more in terms of thinking about, well, look, there is this legacy of empire. Just because the empire's over doesn't mean that its penumbra, its aftermath has gone away. But this continuing sense that actually Britain as an imperial power in the past is in some ways having to cope with the aftermath of that in terms of providing, you know, everything from scholarships to input and output on agriculture and so forth as part of that. It was actually a Labour government, I think, in 1964 under Harold Wilson that first invented what became, I think, the Overseas Development Agency, although that drew on a lot of things, including, I mean, I think it's not coincidental that 1964 is, I think, the last year that Britain had a colonial secretary in the cabinet. I think it was Arthur Bottomley. And I think after that point, there were no more colonial secretaries for obvious reasons. Those who take a particular view about whether, you know, the story says the same, but the language changes, might argue that the emergence of that sort of British interest in overseas aid might have been a way of trying to continue that link. And yet at the same time, if you look at the outcry, which existed in many parts of the world about Britain's abolition of DFID, the Department for International Development, about 2 or 3 years ago, a lot of that was based very much on the idea that actually, for an awful lot of reasons, that agency had done a great deal of good in the wider world and was actually genuinely regarded as a partner, not as, you know, a kind of neocolonial institution in a very large number of global South societies. And seeing it suddenly disappear and essentially becoming an arm of the Foreign Office was regarded as a negative move. I think it's a stretch to link all of that directly to the Bengal famine, but to the idea of sort of the changing relationship between empire and colonies and then a post-colonial, post-imperial state that needs to find a new role in the world and draws on expertise that one way or another it's developed and tries to do it on a more egalitarian basis. I think it's an interesting story.
Plenty to think about there, as always. That, though, sadly, is all we have time for this episode. Kavita, thank you so much for joining us, and Hannah and Rana, thank you both so much, as always, for your time. We'll be back at the start of May, but for now, goodbye.